Virtually Speaking Science. It is Wednesday, September 25, 2015. We are hosted in Second Life by the Exploratorium, where we are joined by a digitally present studio audience who comment and pose questions in real time. Many of the books discussed in our hour-long podcast can be found online in the Virtually Speaking collection at exploratorium.edu. Today's host is Kelly Hills, ethicist, professional editor and writer in the medical sciences and humanities. Kelly publishes her ethics-focused commentaries, where she considers the ethical, legal, and social implications of emerging technologies, DIY biotech, clinical medicine, and public health, first and most frequently on life as an extreme sport. Today, Kelly talks with historian Alice Drager, professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at the Feinberg School of Medicine of Northwestern University in Chicago. Both an activist and academic, Alice's field is the history of anatomy. They'll discuss her new book, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science, in which Drager writes about her work advocating for changes in medical treatment for intersex people and her investigations into what she sees as smear campaigns against researchers with controversial ideas. And with that, we are over to you, Kelly.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for that great introduction, Sherry. Thanks to Exploratorium, one of my favorite places on the planet, for hosting us here in Second Life. And I am so thrilled to have Alice Drager here with us tonight, folks. She's here because she's got a brand new book. It just came out 2 weeks ago, called Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. But Alice is a friend, and I'm just going to put that out up front. Ethics, conflicts of interest, all of that? Well, conflict of interest. Alice is first and foremost a good friend of mine. And more importantly, Alice is actually the person, one of the three people, I should say, who really dragged me kicking and screaming back into bioethics a couple of years ago after I was sure I was done with the field. And then someone pointed out this thing to me on fetal dex, which we'll get to in a minute. And I wrote a blog post because I was just irritated, which you'll note is a going theme for most of my blog posts. And I was irritated because this researcher up in New York City was basically saying that women were broken if they didn't want to be mothers, and that she had this solution to a whole host of reasons that women might not be feminine enough. And that just horrified me. And it was all being done in utero. And Alice had written about it on this website, and I had stumbled across it, and I wrote about it. And then Alice actually reached out and made a comment on my blog. And being a student of bioethics, of course, I had Alice's previous books. I've read her work in class, and I was all, oh my gosh, an actual celebrity in bioethics is talking to me. And then Alice immediately was like, I'm not a bioethicist. And from that, we pretty much have been friends ever since. So thank you so much for being here tonight, Alice. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to you.
Oh, it's always a delight to talk to you, Kelly. Thank you for that very nice introduction.
Y'all can find on my Twitter feed, I posted two of the links to some stuff I wrote, one about Alice and fetal dex, and then secondly, she egged me on to write about some notions in bioethics, and then she dragged me off to Halifax, and we've done all kinds of fun stuff since then. And you can certainly find that stuff on my Twitter feed. But tonight, we're going to focus on Alice's book, which you have to go out and buy. I cannot stress this enough because, I kid you not, I read this entire book in 4 hours. I could not put it down. I was like, yeah. I know Glenn Cohen's my guest for the next Virtually Speaking Science, and I need to finish his book, but Alice's book is here, and I have to read it because she'd been writing it for the last couple of years. And it is that engaging. It is literally page-turning. You can't put it down. And the first thing you notice when you pick it up is Galileo is flipping you off. Alice, why is Galileo flipping us off on the cover of this book?
Well, the cover is allegorical, and so actually when Penguin sent me the mock-up of the cover, I thought they were kidding because it seemed like such a hilarious front cover. I knew that that was going to be the title of the book because I had suggested that, but the picture was so perfect. It is an old painting of Galileo, And he's actually not in the real painting holding up his middle finger, but they've digitally blurred it out, so it looks like he's flipping you the bird. The reason it's called Galileo's Middle Finger is it takes as its sort of central theme the story of what happened to Galileo, which was persecution of a scientist for ideological reasons, not because his science was wrong, but because it threatened people in power, namely the Catholic Church. So I tell the story of how I came upon this middle finger in graduate school, and I won't get in all into that, but the fact is when Galileo died, he was out of favor with the Church, so he was buried in an ordinary grave. And about 100 years later, they realized he was incredibly important. He was a hero of science, a hero of the area of Italy. So they dug him up to bury him in a fancier grave. And when they were doing so, one of his devotees decided to cut off a few of his fingers, because that's what you did with sort of saints and heroes, and you save these as relics. And one of them ended up mounted on a pillar. And when I came upon this in graduate school, I just thought it was so hilarious that there would be this icon of Galileo who had been screwed over, basically flipping the universe a bird, but also pointing to the sky, and that's really the point of it, the reason it's displayed, and saying sort of to the universe, you know, I was right, and if you look at the sky, you'll see that I was right. In Italy, of course, the middle finger is not the gesture you use to flip somebody off, but it is the United States. So I thought it was sort of the perfect metaphor for what I was looking at, which was scientists being attacked for ideological reasons because they were threatening particular identity groups, and them sort of trying to fight back by saying, if you just look at the universe clearly, then you'll be able to see what I'm seeing.
That's a really interesting idea, this notion of looking at the universe clearly. Back to that. But I think that Galileo, that's just so fascinating that, you know, you come across Galileo's middle finger, and naturally, of course, like you said, it doesn't mean the same thing in Italy as it does here, but it's just kind of, I can see a lot of humor in stumbling across that. That's actually a little bit of maybe shock out of the situation, because I'm not sure if you're looking around, I believe this was a display of his telescopes and such, that you would necessarily expect to then just kind of trip across somebody's petrified middle finger in
When I was in graduate school, Kelly, and I ended up in that museum in Florence, the reason I was going was to see his telescopes. It wasn't because I knew there was a finger there. And actually, when I came upon the finger, I had no idea what it was because it's so disgusting looking. And I had to pull out the guidebook, the English language guidebook, and read about it. And when I did, I just started cracking up completely, which the docent did not appreciate because this is supposed to be a quiet museum. But I just thought it so incredibly funny that this guy who was quite arrogant, quite belligerent, but also right, ended up sort of just giving this gesture to the universe. It just struck me as so incredibly funny. But, you know, I didn't say to myself then, oh, someday I'm going to use that as the title of the book. It just got shelved in my mind as a funny story. But as I was working on this book and I kept meeting people who have what I call in the book the Galilean personality, it occurred to me that this was really sort of one of the reasons that scientists get in trouble is because some of them have these kinds of personalities that are very determined, very persistent, and very convinced that the truth is going to save them. And they persist far beyond the point at which you think that they could persist because they do come under attack.
I think that probably not giving away too much of the book to actually talk about the Galilean personality, I actually found that really interesting. I've been working a lot more with scientists in my day job, and I'm certainly stumbling across that particular mix of arrogance and certainty that seems to find its way especially into the sciences. And I can see that Galilean personality, but Alice, if you don't mind, could you kind of share with the audience a little bit what you mean by a Galilean personality? And in particular, I guess because I know I've read a couple of reviews now where people pick up the book and think that this is going to be about way back historical issues of science and ethics and heretics and stuff. And it seems to be people are a little surprised to be like, oh, we're talking about things that are from like 20 years ago to a week ago. So,
you would think that the digital blurring on the front cover would give you a clue that it's not really about Galileo. But also the jacket cover, which describes what the book is about. But, you know, one of my friends joked, what do these people think To Kill a Mockingbird is about? Exactly. So if you take titles literally. It is an allegorical title, and it does talk a little bit about Galileo, but it really is about contemporary scientists. And what I mean by the Galilean personality is this sort of interesting personality where somebody is very persistent, very devoted to science, very much interested in sort of trying to find out what is true, and then what I would call tone dumb. So it's not that they're tone deaf. They know that people around them are objecting to what they're saying, but they don't care, and they don't know how to speak in a way that's politically correct. So we're talking about scientists who make claims today, mostly about human identity is what gets you in trouble, especially where sex is concerned. So claims about the origins of sexual orientation, claims about the nature of gender, claims about where violence comes from, where rape comes from. These are typically claims that are met with the sort of outrage because they don't meet the standard party line. And what's different about the scientists within my book that have the Galilean personality is that they don't give up. They persist and persist and persist, even though they're in a lot of trouble. And Galileo was in a huge amount of trouble, yet he persisted, really past the point of safety. And that's not because he didn't get scared. Like all these scientists I've talked to, he did at some point become genuinely scared, and legitimately so. But he sort of kept believing that if he could just get other people to sort of be sensible and look at what he was seeing, that they would see that he was right. And, you know, part of what's involved with the Galilean personality is this sort of persistence also in terms of, in some ways, getting so involved in your science that your science, to some extent, becomes about yourself. With Galileo, it's important to know that he wasn't right about everything. So he had this whole idea about the tides and how the tides worked that were clearly against the evidence, and yet he sort of couldn't give it up because he had decided he was right about that, and it was further proof of the Copernican system. So it's this kind of personality that makes you persist.
One of the chapters in here that was actually talking about transgender identity, which, as everyone I think knows, especially right now, is a very touchy topic that people are often very badly tripping over themselves on and discussing. And I think a lot of people are probably going to be surprised to learn that these have been going on for at least 20, 25 years now, if not a little longer, just because it hasn't been so in the forefront of pop culture and society. There wasn't an internet 25 years ago. There wasn't Amazon showing Transparent winning awards, things like that. And yet, you know, there are people who are doing research about it, who are getting in trouble with activists, including you, kind of. And then you suddenly flip over to the other side and you're talking to the researchers and seeing how activism has actually been used to almost, I don't want to say used, engender a chilling effect, because that has some really particular First Amendment connotations here in America, but it certainly seems to try and stifle research that might be going down a path that can be portrayed in a politically incorrect way if somebody isn't careful. And one of the things I liked when you got to the end of this chapter that kind of, you know, had me bristling a little bit at some points that were being said by some of the researchers, where I'm like, oh, if you put that on the internet today, you'd be eviscerated by activists. The idea that very femme trans children grow up and are very good for being working in the sex trade because they have a high sex drive. And I was just wincing at that. And I like how you kind of, at the end of this chapter, after you hadn't said much about that at all, pointed out really kind of flat out that a friend of yours took issue with this because, you know, it was a generalization that probably got in the way of otherwise good science. And it seems that possibly it gets tricky when you're starting to talk about identity politics, because how do you know where that line is? How do you know when you've gotten to something that's really science and really something that is the tides and a wrong idea?
Yeah, well, I think that's why it takes peer review, why it takes feedback from people, why it takes repeatability of studies and all of that, because one individual never can figure out what is true. By definition, we figure out what is true based on consensus. And I'm not saying that there isn't external truth, but the way that we know we're getting closer to truth tends to be because we've reached consensus and because we test things in the world. And so there are things that are testable in the world. The challenge with human identity is that it can be very hard to test those kinds of theories in the world. But, you know, science gets us better stuff. I mean, we have airplanes. We have treatments for AIDS, if not a cure, or a vaccine for AIDS yet. You know, we have all sorts of things that science gets us in terms of reliable knowledge. And so the way we get there is not one individual. I mean, certainly Charles Darwin, for example, came up with an incredibly important theory, but parts of Darwin's understanding were wrong. He ended up with this crazy idea about pan genes, which developed a sort of Lamarckian attitude that you could end up having passed into the germline traits that you acquire during your lifetime. So all scientists get some stuff wrong, and the way that we figure out what's right and what's wrong is to try to do consensus, try to test each other, try to do repeatability, all these kinds of things. And I think that's no different when you're talking about human identity issues. What gets people, I think, in a lot of trouble is when there's been a sort of blanket statement out in the world about some issue. I mean, a good example would be that rape is always about power. And then scientists try to inject some subtlety into that, and they get in terrible trouble because it sounds like you're only allowed to think one particular thing. And if you're a good person, then you buy the party line of the oppressed group. And if you at all challenge the party line of the oppressed group, then somehow you're part of the oppressors. And that's not where a lot of these scientists are. They're actually trying to figure out sort of the nuances and the subtleties and how to figure out sustainable policy, but they get attacked because we're all supposed to buy particular party lines. So, I mean, my general approach in the world nowadays is to try to not be loyal to anything or anyone, because I think that's what allows you to sort of free up and say, oh, yeah, there's a dangerous idea. Well, let's go think about that one. You know, there was a funny point. The person who made that comment that you're talking about is Mike Bailey, who's a Northwestern psychology researcher. And you know, I remember one day when I was in the midst of this book, it's in chapter 4, the chapter where I go to Mizzou, the University of Missouri at Columbia, where I sort of have this revelation that, you know, that researchers really had to be special in the world, and they had to go and go and do dangerous work, because we were the only person who could do that in the universe in terms of not being hopefully beholden to corporations and not limited by the government, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember saying to Mike after that visit, like, I want to start a new journal called the Journal of Dangerous Ideas. And Mike said to me, Alice, shouldn't all journals be journals of dangerous ideas? And I realized, oh, yeah, that's completely right. Right? But I had gotten so used to the idea that within a particular journal there are things we're allowed to say and not allowed to say, that the dangerous ideas are not permitted, that I've become really fascinated by dangerous ideas.
I think that one of the things that makes it really difficult, especially with some of the more, I guess, dangerous ideas today, is, as you said, it's about identity. And it seems like a lot of these people who end up getting in trouble, and you noted this in the book, but it's kind of hard not to note, most of the case studies are actually examples of straight white men in power.
That's partly because people pay more attention to their work.
Well, yes. As some of us were discussing earlier this week, oftentimes women can say things 5 or 6 times, but no one listens until the man in the room speaks up. And there's a great New Yorker cartoon about that. It was hard not to notice that we're talking about guys who are traditionally in positions of power, talking identity of people who aren't. And I know that something that's very common now in, I guess, identity politics is to allow the people who are minorities to try and, you know, declare their own state of being, if you will. But that can also become problematic in and of itself, because oftentimes people involved in identity politics are activists, not scientists. And I think the idea of being tone dumb is a really interesting one, because a lot of these white cis males seem to have really good intent, but are just phrasing things in such a way that there's no way that you can expect people who are hearing themselves described to not get offended. And I don't know, do you see a way around that, or is this just kind of a casualty of a Galilean personality?
Well, I mean, it is true that some of the stuff these guys have said, it was so unnecessary in terms of being overly inflammatory. And this is one thing I've taken a lot of time of talking to scientists about is, you know, I know it's tempting to say things in the most inflammatory fashion, but it's ultimately not really worth it. The other thing that happens, I mean, we have to notice, is that sometimes the scientists don't phrase things in inflammatory ways. Sometimes they're actually being pretty subtle, but the journalists choose to pick it up and to portray it in ways that are very simplistic. And then the claims made there end up being accrued back to the scientists. So I've had this own experience, for example, where I've published an op-ed. This happened to me years ago in the New York Times, where I published an op-ed, and they chose for the pull quote, and for people who don't know what a pull quote is, that's the big print in the center of the article that's a quote from the article. But for the pull quote, they chose something that I hadn't said. They decided to distill what I was saying and put it in their own words. And the consequence of that is I'm constantly quoted as having said that. It's not something I disagree with, but I didn't write it, and I didn't say it. And what does happen is headlines can be very sensationalistic. Claims made about scientists' work can be sensationalistic. But I think scientists really do need some training in terms of understanding how not to be unnecessarily inflammatory. So at the Human Behavior and Evolution Society this year, which actually coincidentally will be in Columbia, Missouri, which is where one of the chapters of my book takes place, the advice goddess, Amy Aklon, and I are actually co-presenting a symposium, which is a how-to symposium about how to tell scientists to be careful. And it's called, Up Schitt's Creek and How to Build Yourself a Paddle, which is supposed a tour up Schitt's Creek and how to build yourself a paddle. So the goal of that session that we're doing is trying to explain to people what it looks like as you're heading up Schitt's Creek so that you know you're headed up that way. And then how do you defend yourself in terms of trying not to make yourself your own worst problem?
Yeah, that I think would do a lot of people a lot of good. Not necessarily just scientists, but I have to say, especially scientists.
But they don't always want to listen. They want to feel like, because they do have that Galilean attitude. It's like, the truth will save me. Yes, I may be persecuted, but persecution is evidence that I'm right. That's one of the things they do, by the way, is believe that persecution is evidence that they're right. I don't think that that's correct. I don't think persecution is evidence of being right.
I certainly hope not, because there would be a lot of things out there that would have to change, and that would probably be for the worse.
Yeah. So, I mean, I still see all the time scientists using phrases that are unnecessary. So, for example, among the evolutionary anthropologists and the evolutionary psychologists, some of them will use the phrase good genes. And what they mean by that is genes that improve reproductive fitness. But using the term good, as you know, is a very moralistic term. And so saying, you know, good genes implies a sort of moralism to it that nature doesn't have. And I try to explain to them, you know, you really need to talk about reproductive fitness. And they're like, well, it's quicker to say good genes. You know,
yeah,
like,
and I would probably think twice if I saw someone saying even reproductive fitness, just thinking back to the good gene good family contests that happened in the 1910s and 1920s, you know, here in America, pre-Nazis and oh my God, eugenics are horrible, when America was actually embracing the notion of eugenics. And I know today if I saw someone going, reproductive fitness, I'd be like, are we dog whistling here? And
when we do talk about human evolution, we are evolved beings, so we have to talk about what makes us more reproductively fit,
right,
in the sense of what leaves more offspring. So, yeah, it can be tricky. I mean, some of this stuff is always tricky because of the heavy baggage and the heavy history behind them.
And, excuse me, my apologies, folks. It's spring here in Philadelphia, and that means my allergies have returned with a vengeance. I think that... especially for folks who have any familiarity with the history of science, medicine, and minority groups of any type, you kind of start getting a little stepping back from the line, maybe go find something else to do, time to wash my hair when certain phrases come up. And at least for me, good gene would definitely be one. It would either be that or it would be you know, slam down the visor, time to go charge a windmill sort of thing. It's definitely fighting words. I guess kind of connected to that, do you think that, I guess, in this age of new media, social media, the standard fourth estate sort of affairs of the New Yorker, New York Times and such, possibly not having as much pull anymore, is it necessary for scientists to have media training? Is it more necessary?
Yeah, I actually think all researchers should get media training. And I constantly encourage people to do it, but very, very few of them do it. And it's frustrating to me because it can be incredibly useful. So for people who don't know, what media training involves is working with a media professional who will help you understand how to make clear your points that in a way that's accurate but doesn't go on and confuse people, and also how to work with questions that are questions that don't make sense, questions that are inappropriate, questions designed to entrap you, all these kinds of things. And if a good media trainer will have you practice, they'll also help you with basic things like, you know, what to wear and how to deal with the pace of your voice. I always speak too fast as I say that.
Yeah.
But all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's funny. So I was on Chicago Tonight last week, and it was a live interview about my book. And my book is, you know, dense, as you know. It moves fast, but it's got a lot in it. And so it's challenging in some ways for interviewers to manage it. And the interviewer was terrific. And, you know, he was shooting me questions quickly. And we had not done – I had talked to a producer in advance, but I had not talked to this guy in advance, and I didn't know what the questions were going to be. And people afterwards asked me, how do you do that? How do you do that? And I tell them, 20 years ago, I got media training, and I've been renewing sort of my media training now and then. But I practice a lot. You know, I practice in my head before an interview with regard to what questions can I expect and how am I going to answer those questions. And yet, over and over again, I see researchers in controversial areas go into this as if simply being a good researcher is the same as knowing how to talk to the public, and it's really not the same. So it's, Galileo needed media training. There was no media, but he needed a little media training in terms of how to talk to the Inquisition. He was really not prepared adequately for talking to the Inquisition.
A little bit of arrogance there that his political connections would protect him, possibly got pulled up a bit short there.
Yes, and I think this is part of the reason why white straight cis men are often shocked is because they're used to a life where people take care of them, and when suddenly this happens, they're completely out of their league. And, you know, if you ever want to see somebody really in a situation where people can set upon them and the person at the center of it has no idea what to do, the truth is it's those guys, because they're not used to a situation where they're not in power, and they're very disoriented, and often they flail wildly, and it becomes a real problem for them.
Yeah. I guess related to this, one of our viewers has a question from Second Life. She would like to know if by pulling your punches and sort of soft selling your thoughts, so being a little bit more politically correct in how you respond to people or what you say, saying things like reproductive fitness or survival of the fittest gene instead of good genes, do you risk the dumbing down your thoughts to a lowest common denominator and not actually getting your point across? Not because people are offended, because it's so buried in soft languages that it's just the point's completely lost. And, you know, it's so buried under niceness and being gentle to people's feelings and everything that you kind of missed the point. She's wondering if,
yes,
you know.
Yes, definitely you can do that. And what's much better, of course, is bringing the public, bringing your audience to a higher level of understanding rather than going to their level and requiring to be kept in their level of dialogue. So that's clearly better, is if we can pull people up. And, you know, people are very capable of that. I think researchers often underestimate how much education you can do if you speak clearly in terms of bringing people into the science and how eager people are to be brought into the science. I mean, you know, the science-loving attitude of the American people is very high. People really like learning intense science.
Okay.
The challenges become, I think, when there are certain narratives that are so set in our cultural systems that if somebody's trying to inject some subtlety, it can take a long time before they achieve it. And so that's really the difficulty. And it can be it can be quite difficult to figure out how, if you're in a totally different plane in terms of where you're thinking about something, you're not even on the same spectrum of where the public discourse is, how do you come into that public discourse and bring people to that totally different plane? And that can be extremely challenging to do. And, you know, what ends up happening is, as I trace in the book, there are these real good and evil stories out in our system, and instead people get sort of slotted into the good and evil stories, and those are very frustrating. I tried in the book to be really careful not to be simplistic about the good and evil stories. You know, I make clear that some of these researchers who I'm so-called defending are people who also irritate me sometimes. And I don't think that there are any simple heroes. And I don't think there are any simple villains either. I mean, you know, as I say at the end of the book, and I hope people understand what I mean, I think most of the Nazis didn't think they were Nazis. You know, the world is complicated in terms of how we exist in it. That doesn't mean the Nazis weren't awful. They were. But it is to say that the way we understand ourselves is very complicated.
Yeah, I think that what Ilse might have been getting at is that sometimes it's better if a scientist might be a little opaque at first, but I think opacity might be a little bit different than the bluntness that comes across with good gene. Maybe it would be better to actually say something more like, you know, the fitness to reproduce or to pass on traits. It takes a little bit longer to say, and it might not be clear up front, but like you say, you know, it's not, Americans aren't dumb as popular narratives that can't be right now, and perhaps being a little bit more technical gets away from the offensiveness and encourages people to engage a little bit more. Yeah, I don't know.
Sometimes,
it's an interesting question.
But again, there's always the risk that the journalist will do the dumbing down for you and do it wrong.
It's
has a good point. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Spending time in science communication and seeing what passes sometimes for journalism these days, I feel for anybody who has a scientific paper coming out and is hoping for media coverage, because that's got to be a double-edged sword. You've got to be sitting there going, yes, I want media coverage, except I kind of don't want media coverage. Could I have, like, the good media coverage, but could we get maybe the Daily Mail to ignore what I said, kind of, you know, thing?
If only.
Right? Well, you've had some interesting experiences with media coverage, especially the Fetal Dex situation. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, that is how we got to know each other. And do you want to maybe give the capsule elevator version of what the Fetal Dex situation is, just to get our listeners up to date?
Sure, and this will be a good example of not dumbing it down too much, because it's complicated and requires some science. So there is a genetic condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, and in that case, what happens is the body naturally has the adrenal glands, which are endocrine glands in our back or lower back, sort of in too high a gear. And what that can mean is a danger to the person who has this disease. It can lead to a stress situation in terms of the hormonal responses to the world. A person who has CAH has to be medically monitored and take medication for it. A side effect of this is that in female fetuses, if the androgen levels are high, one of the androgens is testosterone. These are what we call masculinizing hormones. So if you have a female fetus with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, what can happen is the genitals and also the brain can go down a more male typical pathway than would ordinarily happen in an XX fetus. And so for the females, that can mean intersex genital development. So genital development in between the male or the female type, or even sometimes quite close to the male type. And what's happened is that medical researchers believe that if they give women at risk of having a daughter with this condition the drug dexamethasone, or we call it Dex for short, it's a steroid, that if you give that as soon as you know the woman is pregnant, you can prevent the androgen level being too high in terms of its effects, and you can get the female to develop along the typical female pathway. Now, because this is an autosomal recessive trait, that means that it only affects the females in this intersex way, only one out of eight of the pregnancies in which the parents are at risk of having a child with this situation. Only one out of eight will actually be a girl with this issue. And so they're hitting all of these fetuses who don't have the condition in an attempt to try to prevent it in the one out of eight in these families. But the bigger issue that came up was that the parents were being told by this major proponent of it, a woman named Maria New, who's a very distinguished pediatric endocrinologist. Dr. New is telling parents that this had been found safe for mother and child, when in fact it wasn't established as safe. It was not FDA approved as a use. Ooh. And then she was putting them into a database and then getting NIH funding to study whether or not it was in fact safe. And so essentially they were being brought in as patients and provided this so-called treatment, and then later being used as research subjects to see what really happened to them. So there was this kind of doublespeak going on. And
so basically she was, hang on, Alf, I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, because it's still one of those things that makes me pause, and I know the story pretty well at this point. But so Dr. New was basically creating a patient population that she was then going to follow up on in actual approved NIH studies.
She says is that she didn't write the prescription. She got the obstetricians to write the prescriptions, but it's very clear that she's been the person pushing the approach. She's the person who talks to the obstetrician. She's the one who does the genetic counseling, and then she's the one who enters them into her database and then goes to the NIH and says, I have a certain number of these people, and they're a fascinating population because we can use this to study sexual orientation and gender and sex development and all the rest of it. And as I show in the book, I mean, spoiler alert, what I think happened, because I ended up doing a 3.5-year investigation of this, what I think ended up happening is that most of the families never knew they were in an experiment, and the NIH didn't know they weren't in an experiment. The NIH thought that these people were being told right from the beginning that this was an experimental drug use, that this had risks to it, and that they had decided to participate in medical research involving their fetuses being exposed to something that was intentionally changing fetal development. This is an extraordinary situation because all of the research protections set up in this country are especially directed at fetal research. Pregnant women and fetuses are not supposed to be in research trials in most cases because of our belief that, you know, the fetus could come to harm. But this is even worse than that, because this was one where they knew it crossed the placental barrier. They knew it changed fetal development. That was the goal of it. So to be doing that and to have 7 out of 8 of the fetuses not even stand any benefit from it, and then to be telling the parents that this has been found safe and to be bringing them in as ordinary patients and then later studying them is just, it's just an insane situation and very upsetting and very disturbing, as it turns out.
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me when I started actually looking into the details beyond my initial irritation just at the emphasis placed on motherhood was that the parents, you know, these pregnant women are being told that it's perfectly safe for this to affect their embryo, really, because we're talking about a point of development before fetus even, and then turning around and saying, we don't actually know if this is safe or not, to the NIH and other grant-giving agencies asking for money to study whether or not this is safe and by following up with these patients years down the line. And it's absolutely astonishing to me to go through your transcripts and see, on the one hand, she's speaking to patient groups saying this is safe, and then literally on the other hand is putting together NIH applications saying, we don't know if this is safe. We should probably do follow-ups and see if this is safe.
Well, and in the NIH grant, as I show, she wasn't just doing retrospective studies looking backwards. She was actually telling the NIH that she was enrolling fetuses as research subjects, but I can't find evidence that those women actually consented to it as a research trial. So that's what's really disturbing,
yeah,
how this all played out. And we should clarify, Kelly, when you're talking about the motherhood issue, so what happens with these fetuses that have CAH, because the androgen effect can affect the brain as well, there's some, well, we think that's why, there's evidence among this population of 46XX females who have this condition that they have a lower interest in becoming mothers. They have a higher rate of being either lesbians or bisexuals. They have a higher rate of also being transgender in terms of being female to male transgender individuals. And so there's some reasonably good evidence in this population that things like gender identity and things like sexual orientation have some biological component to it. And then also the interest in motherhood was a big concern of Maria New. And one of the things she was saying to the NIH was that they could use these studies to figure out whether or not they might be able to increase these girls' ultimate interest in becoming mothers, which was so bizarre to be reading, right? As late as 2010, she's writing about this, saying in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences, telling people, you know, there's the possibility that dexamethasone will fix these behavioral abnormalities, that these women don't want to be mothers and that they have sexual interest in other women. And it's just so amazing, you know. But one of the things you have to remember is Maria New is in her mid-80s now. She was really part of the population of the 1950s doctors who developed this system of treating people with intersex. It was a very homophobic system, a very sexist system, and a very heterosexual system. So it's not too surprising that she has this approach. What's surprising in some ways is that she's still practicing this late into her career, but also with this many problems accrued.
Yeah, it's very surprising to me also that that's just apparently something she says over and over again, and nobody stands up and goes, hang on. I mean, it's really shocking to me that it took until, I believe your letter was 2010, Alice and 30-odd other bioethicists and people.
Yeah, the lead author on the letters was Ellen Feder of the American University.
Yes.
Well, you know, the thing is, people had stood up. That was what was interesting. Medical societies had actually stood up to her in journals, in conferences, in consensus papers, and said, this is so incredibly dangerous. You should only do this in the strictest drug trial systems, you know, where you have full and informed consent, where you have data safety monitoring boards. I mean, they were calling for the best scientific and best ethical approach, and she was just ignoring them. So this was the American Academy of Pediatrics, the European and American Pediatric Endocrine Societies, of which she had been, you know, a major leader in those years. They were all saying to her, this is so dangerous and so risky, and these parents have to be told the truth about what we don't know. But she just proceeded as if all of that stuff didn't matter. So that's why actually the doctors the clinicians who came to me in 2009 did, because they said, you know, they've tried everything else. They've called her out in the medical journals. They've tried, like, calling her out literally in conferences, and she just keeps telling the parents this. And what can we do? What can we possibly do? She's the lead researcher in this field of CAH. And so one of the reasons they came to me was because they said, you know, you approach unusual problems with unusual approaches, and we need something different here to try to protect the rights of these parents. So that's why I got involved and was stupid and naive, and I thought it wouldn't be very difficult to stop this because it was so obviously outrageous. It was so obviously crazy. Everybody saw how crazy it was. Everybody who had looked saw how crazy it was. I thought it would be so easy that I'd go to the reporters I knew. They would immediately see what I was seeing and what everybody else was seeing. They would immediately write up a story, and that is not what happened because the investigative press at that point had collapsed. I had to do it all myself, which was really shocking and surprising, and it really made clear to me how dangerous the systems are right now for patients and for people who become subjects without even realizing they're becoming research subjects.
Yeah, I think that would actually probably interest our listeners. Went a little bit further in that direction. So I had read to my husband your little bit about how, oh, this is going to be easy. This is clearly an ethical violation. We'll just call the New York Times, call the Washington Post, tell the FDA, tell the Office of Human Subjects Research Protections, and, you know, everyone's just going to go, oh, my God, stop doing unapproved and, you know.
Right. That's what you would think.
Research on fetuses, you know, stop experimenting on the unborn. This does not seem like it's a very big hurdle to jump over, right? And at the same time, I was reading that going, oh, Alice is such an optimist. I would have never guessed that. And honestly, I kind of hit that at the beginning of every chapter of the book. It was like, oh, she's still an optimist. You know, every chapter you approach one of these new, really big issues, intersex, transgender, sociobiology, and Native ethnic Indian studies and on and on. And each time you seem to approach it with such a, this is so obvious, clearly everyone will know and it'll be easy, and then everything collapses around you and it happens again with the new. And I thought it was,
you know,
hilarious.
It's evidence of the Galilean personality, right? I keep thinking that truth is sort of going to, we're all going to agree. We're going to look at the same planets. We're going to look at the moons. You know, we're going to look at the sunspots, and we're all going to say, well, it's very obvious Copernicus is right. And yet, I mean, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it does happen in some of these cases that, you know, I did enough research and did enough peer-reviewed research and put it out there enough and worked with enough journalists that I managed to turn some of these stories around. But at the same time, you're right. It's remarkable to me that I can look at myself in that book and think, what the fuck are you thinking? Like, what are you thinking? Like, but it's funny,
so,
because
okay.
You're right. I just keep doing it.
So you get to this fetal sex problem. You think, I know exactly what to do as an activist. This will be easy. We'll have it solved in a weekend, and we'll all go get tea and biscuits. The reality is a little bit different. And so I know that you wrote letters to various governmental agencies thinking that that would get some play. And, you know, that
thinking
people would
they'd
be
fix
like,
it. I mean, I actually thought they would fix it.
Well, you know, that they would go, there's no registered clinical trial here. This is a problem. And, you know, fix things, you know, put a stop to it, make things happen that are ethical and good. And what actually happened?
Well, what actually happened was a couple of people who are ethicists within the medical industrial research complex and were, I later found out, actually all sort of being paid by the medical schools I was going after or indirectly being brought into that group, they came after me and my colleagues and called us unethical and transgressive and published an article in the American Journal of Bioethics, which we should disclose. You have a history with that journal that's an unpleasant history. My history with them is deeply unpleasant. People think that it couldn't possibly be the case that a journal called the American Journal of Bioethics could be phenomenally unethical. It's like ground zero for bad behavior. And they came after me, and I didn't realize that they were that it was kind of a setup in a way, and so I was sort of thrown for a loop and shocked. And then it turned out that the governmental agencies had sort of been a combination of duped and in collaboration with them, and they basically wrote it off as nothing to see here, which was totally shocking to me. And, again, spoiler alert, they coordinated their responses so that it all came upon me on literally the same day. And I thought I had screwed everything up. I thought I was wrong about everything. And it was a very, very ugly moment. I had to be honest, call my partner home from work because I was afraid that I was going to off myself from the stress of realizing that the government and AJOB, the American Journal of Bioethics, had all said I was wrong all on the same day. But my partner, who's very sensible, told me, you know, you got to stop acting like a beaten dog. You got to act like a historian. If what you really believe in is searching for the truth, then you got to figure out if you were wrong or you were right. And you can't trust these people to tell you were you wrong or were you right, because everything you're seeing suggests you were right. So he said, FOIA everything. That's used the Freedom of Information Act to FOIA everything you can possibly get and find out what you really know. So I, you know, bit my teeth and FOIA'd, and I had to sue the government to actually get the responses because they wouldn't respond, and I got about 9,500 pages over the course of 3 years, and I was able to go through it all and actually show that there was one thing I was wrong about, and that was that I didn't think that New had gotten ethics board approval to do fetal research. She had, but from everything I can find, it looks like most of the families were not, in fact, enrolled in any studies. So in other words, she was getting approval to do the studies from the beginning, but she wasn't actually bothering to enroll those people in it, and the difference is important. But it also allowed her, I think that's how she was able to go to the NIH and get the funding and lead them to believe she was doing appropriate fetal research, because she showed them the approvals. But they don't ask to see this in the consent forms. So, and they don't ask for, you know, proof that people are actually being enrolled appropriately in the trials. So I was wrong about that, and that was useful. I talk about in the book that was one thing that we got wrong. But the rest of it, we were pretty much right. I mean, it was the case that she was absolutely telling the parents that this was safe. And then as far as I can tell, not appropriately enrolling at least most of them in these trials, from what I can tell, because when she's asked where are the forms, she comes back and says, oh, these were ordinary patients who asked for it. She says it was done at their request.
Right.
The parents
so
had requested
it. So since they're requesting it, it's off-label compassionate use, and it's
and then
trial,
she writes the grants
so.
To the NIH listing these families as research subjects and using them as research subjects to get ever more grants. Doesn't publish most of the outcomes, which is curious why they kept funding her, because there was not the publications coming out of it that you would have expected. And it was sort of a long-term system of doing this. So in the end, it turned out that, I mean, it's interesting. The one of the agencies I appealed to actually had looked into this in 2003 and had basically seen what I saw, but thought that she was leaving medical research at that point, and they dropped it because they thought she was leaving. What they didn't realize is she was moving on to a new university and keeping it up. And the other agency, the FDA, was just a total letdown because the FDA researcher was involved with the AJOB crowd, which I didn't realize, the American Journal of Bioethics crowd. So that was the whole cluster, such and such. So it's a bit of a thriller in the end there, but I would not want to live it again. Let me just say that. I never want to live through anything like that again. And people who say, oh, that was so fascinating, I'm like, yeah, it makes a good read, but living it is something else.
Yeah, it's always the interesting stories tend to be the ones that you're not necessarily wanting to relive anytime soon. That does actually kind of tie in, though, because to a question that was actually posed a good 45 minutes ago from somebody in our Second Life audience who's a little curious if you see, given especially your history with the fetal dex incident and the FDA being, shall we say, less than accommodating with your requests for information or acting on anything. Do you see the current moves in Congress to review federal grants they consider to be questionable uses of tax money, analogous to either how Galileo was treated by the church in the persecution because of questioning against the political will of the time, or do you even see it as something that's just doing more of a stifling of research or stifling of people who are questioning research? You know, do you see any analogies, I guess, to
absolutely. I think it's we're always in a dangerous situation when elected officials are choosing to decide, you know, directly which kinds of projects to fund and not to fund. That really has to be left up to the scientific community. That said, one of the things that a lot of scientists point to, and I certainly see it with Dr. New's work, is that there's a sort of clubbiness within certain sections of the NIH or the NSF, and it can be very difficult for anybody different to break into that section or to get funded. And the same people can sometimes get funded over and over again, even though they're unproductive, even though the work that they're doing is sometimes morally problematic in terms of abusive subjects. So I think one of the things that has to happen is there needs to be better organization within groups like the NIH and the NSF to make sure that there's the highest standards of scholarship and not the sort of loyalty and clubbiness that does occur in many situations. But that said, I do not want Congress deciding what gets funded and what doesn't get funded. And that's the situation we're getting into. But we're also in a situation, of course, where our universities are pressuring us to partner with industry, whether that's pharmaceuticals or that's the coal industry or whoever it is, agricultural businesses. And so the pressure within universities is getting ever higher to insist that we bring in external funding. We're being treated like salespeople in a sales force, corporate sales forces. And when we've got that kind of situation, what you're going to do is the kind of research that pays, not the kind of research that matters. So I think that's critically important. As you know, as I tell people, one of the reasons I was able to do this book is because I quit my tenured job when I had a kid and I was doing medical activism. I was doing too much stuff, and so I gave up normal academic life. And I've lived off of my partner, who's a physician and a medical school administrator, and we live in a cheap place in the Midwest, so we can afford to do that. But basically, I've had sort of, I work part-time for Northwestern, at 20%. I'm able to sort of have a seven-year sabbatical to some extent on this, and I was able to do what he always said, which is do what's important, not what pays. And when you're able to do that kind of work, you can do so much better work. You know, Galileo had a patron. He left the university system because the university system required him to do such boring work. And he had a patron who allowed him to do daring work. And without that kind of system where we have patronage within the universities, where instead what we've got is pressure to get government funding or pressure to get corporate funding, what you have is a thing where people go to what's safe and what pays, and that's not often where the best work can be done.
And it's also, I think, important to highlight that just because people are doing what pays doesn't mean that the research they're doing is receiving proper ethical oversight or even ethical research itself. Alice and I both have colleagues who are at the University of Minnesota. Mark Inkson has been discussed frequently on this show, and just in the last week, there's been further developments where an external audit actually said, hey, you know what? This AstraZeneca-funded study probably wasn't as ethical as it should have been. There were a lot of problems with it, and you guys have been stalling on it now for over a decade. And it certainly starts getting a little weird when you've got the people who stand to benefit from the research funding the research and funding the ethics deciding if the research should go on. And it just becomes kind of this very convoluted maze of follow the money and follow the stocks. And you kind of have to stop and wonder who's going to say, hey, wait, slow down, stop.
And something I think a lot of people probably don't even realize happens, where the researchers who are your doctors are being paid to enroll you in the study. So in that case, we're talking about the Markinson case. You know, the physician is basically being paid per head to enroll people in the study and being threatened with withdrawal of the funding if he doesn't enroll enough people. And when you've got that situation, the pressure on your physician to enroll you in a study goes up and up.
It's
problematic. I don't think the average person would by any means think that that was a reasonable system of patient care where your doctor's being paid to make you into a research subject.
Well, Albert would like to know who should decide funding. How should we have a system of funding these kinds of issues, you know,
basically? One of the things we have to do is have more national funding, not less, and what we're getting is a crunching down and reduction of funding. You know, I think that we really do have to have peer review within those systems, but the peer review has to have a lot of rotation going on. You've got to have a situation where things are truly blinded to the best extent possible so that there's not favoritism going on, and try to do it in that way. I think that's the best that we can do in many ways, unless we had enough money to do a national system of lottery where you gave people money regardless and saw what they were going to do in terms of interesting stuff. But the other thing that would be great is if we had more private foundational funding for research that was less restricted. So one of the things that happened for me that really helped was when I set out to do this book, I applied for a Simon Guggenheim Fellowship, and I got that fellowship. It's not a ton of money, but one of the things that the Guggenheim does is they give you the money and they don't require you to do what you proposed. They basically say to you, you know, make a proposal, but we understand you may end up doing something different with the money. I did end up doing what I said, but it took me 7 years instead of 2 years as I had expected it to. And they didn't keep funding me. They give you the lump at the beginning. But Guggenheim in many ways sort of freed me up and said to me, you know, don't worry about producing on this particular timeline. Just be productive and go out there and do the work you feel is important to do. And that was incredibly liberating. I've been fortunate to have a number of private foundation funding along the way that did just that, that said to me, go where you feel it is important. These are not big grants. In the humanities, our work doesn't cost very much. In the sciences, work is much more expensive, so we have to take that into consideration. But I would like to see more foundational funding of people who are interesting researchers, where you would give them more freedom to go where they feel like they need to go, rather than to go where you think it's going to be the biggest media splash or the best for the corporate funding bottom line or that sort of thing, or stuff that won't tick Congress off, because that would be very problematic.
Yeah. So one of the things that you talk about in your book, Alice, is this idea of, I guess, basically, when you're stuck between science and activism, you've got to figure out, you know, who's the one that actually is telling the accurate story, and who's the person who's blowing things up for money, fame, press, agenda. You know, what are the, and I guess to be honest, or accurate, but, you know, there's always agendas, but you have to figure out who has what agenda, and then from there, determine the right person to back. You know, kind of whose side are you going to believe of a story, I guess. You know, you're looking at the Maria New case, and for me, when I came across this, what did I have to do? Well, I read your pieces on it. I went, that's really interesting. Huh. But then I went and I pulled up a couple of her pieces, and I read the literature, and I have the luxury of having access to a lot of literature that's behind paywalls that a lot of people don't have. And I went around, and I probably spent a good day or so actually reading up on this, which is a really small amount of time to be deciding, you know, I'm going to throw my opinion behind this. But, you know, it is what it is. But I at least had the ability to kind of weigh what both sides were saying and decide. I didn't like things that I heard coming out of this one camp, so I was much more inclined to agree with what you and Ellen and other people were saying about fetal decks, and I was going to write my piece and state my position. How do I do this, though, on any kind of large-scale means of evaluation? You know, you have repeated story. I mean, it's basically just chapter after chapter of scientists versus activists. And it's either, you know, an activist has blown things out of proportion for their own agenda, or a scientist has blown things out of proportion for their own agenda. How do you figure out who's who? Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? You know,
well,
the specific terms that nobody wants to have.
Yeah. I think one of the keys to remember is that there are no simple good guys and no simple bad guys, that people do come to these things with their agenda. And that's one of the things I talk about with regard to Galileo in the book, that I think David Wooten, who's done this wonderful biography of Galileo called Galileo, Watcher of the Skies, it's sort of the historian's version of the biography of Galileo, because it's got everything in it. It's very geeky. I loved it, and it was the one that I used really to base my stories of Galileo on in the book. What Wooten shows is that Galileo was not without his own personal psychology involved in his science. So Galileo really was a lapsed Catholic, did not agree with the Catholic point of view, which was that we were in the center of the universe and we were special and God had made us
right.
Special. He was very much into pushing the Copernican view, in part because he thought that the Catholic dogma about what it meant to be human was wrong. And so I think one of the keys to remember is that you do have to look at people's agenda, including your own, as much as possible, but it can be very difficult to know your own agenda. So one of the things that you have to do is get your work out there and try to have it reviewed. But for the average person coming to these things, you're right, it can be very difficult, especially when things are behind paywalls. It can be very hard for people to look at the research. So the move towards putting everything as open access in terms of research is, I think, going to be increasingly important in terms of being able to get people to understand what the research actually shows. But then also trying to educate people within educational systems about how to read research would be helpful, how to make sure people know that not all journals are alike, so some of them are fake journals, and you can have something that looks like it's from a very officious journal, but in fact be essentially a fake piece, forcing people to disclose conflicts of interest that is not happening in an effective way right now, certainly within medicine. We still have a lot of it. But then, to me, one of the most important things is supporting investigative journalism that is the best investigative journalism. So people today assume that their music should be free, that their podcast should be free, that their art should be free, and that their news should be free. And good news is not free of cost. It costs a lot to do good investigative journalism. So supporting groups like ProPublica is one key element as far as I'm concerned. ProPublica is a national independent investigative journalist system that's a nonprofit organization that cooperates with newspapers like the New York Times. And they're having to do the kind of work that in the past the commercial media could afford to do, but today can't afford to do because the Internet has undermined the economy of investigative journalism. So I strongly encourage people as much as possible to support investigative journalism and then to not just read in the places where they're apt to agree with. And that means having to go to places and as much as possible trying to not approach everything with your loyalties, to try to be open to reading what's there. And that can be very difficult. You know, the Cato Institute recently liked my work, which was a little bit shocking, right? But then I started trying to read more carefully about the Cato Institute and trying to understand, is there legitimate research being done there? I think the answer is it's very ideological. But I tried to really approach their stuff on its own terms as much as possible and not approach it simply with the assumption that, you know, this is the evil right wing and I should never believe anything they say. I've ended up not being happy that they think that what I'm saying is the same as what they're saying. They think we're both into academic freedom. I think they're into the idea that we shouldn't look at people's conflicts of interest. It's different. But I think as much as possible, approaching things with disloyalty is key. I think being disloyal is an incredibly important approach. And then also trying to have some degree of humility and recognizing I don't know a lot of things. There's a lot of things in which I simply can't weigh in because I don't know what's going on in that field.
Yeah. Actually, Sherry pipes up in the Second Life chat room that she thinks something that has changed quite a bit is the consolidation of media ownership in creating kind of the current problem of how news is produced or in some ways isn't produced. And I guess to tack on to that, I certainly think the 24/7 media cycle has made science as a whole a much more challenging thing for people to report on. You know, it's Wednesday, The Lancet released some new stuff today on Ebola, and literally 10 minutes after, and I know, you know, of course, a lot of people get these embargoed press releases ahead of time so they can read the reports, talk to the researchers and stuff, but it still always strikes me as a little odd when, you know, the report goes live and within 10 minutes you've got 200 articles that have all been released on it, and
and
you have to read
the
through them
release.
And you kind of, yeah, you're reading through the releases, trying to sift through the releases versus the actual science reporting versus the off-the-cuff stuff. And, you know, this morning it just struck me, especially as I was talking to another reporter about it, that what we were being told versus what was actually in the report as that was important and interesting were two entirely different things. And it was a reflection of the rapidity and the consolidation of the media. And it's hard not to see how that affects our science journalism.
Very negative ways. Yeah, no, it's a big problem. And it's one reason why if you think a paper is going to be important as a scientist, it's really important to carefully draft a press release because that's going to be the way in which the piece is understood.
Yes.
That said, I mean, this business of reporters simply taking a press release and reproducing it as if they wrote it is horrifying. I've been in a situation where I will say I help write my press releases because I want to make sure my university gets exactly right what it is I'm saying. And the stuff I'm saying is politically challenging and nuanced, and so it's really important to me they get it right. So they let me draft my press releases. They then work with me on it. But basically, I'm writing them so that when then it gets reported as if it was written by some other independent journalist, it's like
right.
I'm reading myself being ghostwritten under, you know, I've written it, but it's under their name, and they're reporting it as if it's an objective view of my work, and it horrifies me. I mean, it's horrifying. It's like, oh, my God, that's the worst situation, right, where basically I'm in an echo chamber where it's my voice over and over again, but different people are being ascribed to it. It drives me nuts, and I try to correct it whenever it happens.
Yeah, it seems like it certainly hurts the validity of science reporting when that's what's going on. And it certainly removes the critical element from any kind of reporting. And it does make it easier to get into that echo chamber where you don't hear anyone saying, maybe you should phrase that a little differently because that's bad. And it's becoming easier, I think, too, to just tune that out when occasionally it does happen, especially, you know, you can turn off the TV, you can mute people on Twitter, you can just look away and you don't have to take the challenges to your ideology. I think I know both of us are fighting having your migraine medication and my allergy medication are going to be wearing off relatively soon. I know we're both fighting against
the medicated
that
podcast.
I know, the medicated, slightly tipsy podcast on my part. One of the things that really fascinated me about this, and I don't know if this was an intentional progression on your part or if it's just kind of how you grew as an academic, but it really struck me that the book starts off talking about your work as an activist on intersex issues. And then from there, you go into investigating almost how activism has negatively and often negatively affected and often incorrectly portrayed science by university researchers. And then it kind of flips around at this point, a little over halfway through the book, where now suddenly instead of, you know, defending the university researchers from the activists that you used to be, you are now a university researcher who is also an activist who is pulling at and trying to work against a university researcher. And was that any sort of intentional progression on your part, or was that just kind of the way life took you? And how does that kind of work for you? How does that feel going from being one thing to basically the complete opposite?
You know, there's a chapter that's, the book got shortened over time in order to make it more readable and leaner. Which was good. I mean, the editing was very good. But there's a chapter entirely missing, which is the pivot point chapter that goes in that spot you're talking about, that goes from defending the researchers to suddenly going after a researcher myself.
Uh-huh.
And it was, at the time, it was chapter 8. The chapter numbers changed. And it went through 53 versions before being completely cut. And my agent, who's also an editor, was fantastic. She said to me, "It seems like you've now processed this and it needs to turn into one paragraph at the beginning of the next chapter," which it did, actually. It turned into one paragraph at the beginning of the next chapter. You know, I think that it was not intentional. I did think that when I took on the dexamethasone work, which is where that pivot point is, that it would only be the matter of a couple of months and a couple thousand dollars at the most in terms of what it would cost me to do that work, and that it would be a good example of how you still, even though I want academic freedom, everybody wants academic freedom, you still have to have academic responsibility. And it would be a case of showing a case of terrible academic irresponsibility and how you approach it in a way that's upstanding, that's not sleazy, that's not a smear campaign, that goes directly sort of to the issue, which was this double talk, you know, really goes to that. And that's, as it turns out, not what happened. And the dexamethasone thing turned out to be a very different kind of situation than I thought, especially when people came after me and then suddenly I was in the defensive position. And what I kept telling my friends at that point is, like, it's so ironic because I'm writing a book that's about not being postmodern, right? It's a book that's about following truth. But I'm having the ultimate postmodern experience where the writing of the narrative is directing where my life goes. And the damn book is writing me. And I kept saying to my friend, one of us is going to kill the other. Either I'm going to kill this book or this book is going to kill me. And I want to win, but I'm not convinced I'm going to win. And it was incredibly unpleasant and very difficult. And I never, ever want to write a book like that again that is literally happening as I'm living it, because it was so extremely unpleasant to be in a situation where every day I thought to myself, is this in the book or is this not in the book? Is this in the book or is this not in the book? Because it's such a weird, unpleasant experience.
I have to say, it was very interesting watching you write the book. And, you know, as people I'm sure can figure out, the book just came out. I've known you for a couple of years, so I did know you as you were writing a good amount of this book. And it was interesting to watch the process, because
crying hysterically in Halifax and having people tell me, I think you have PTSD. And being like, really? No kidding.
It was interesting to watch basically the birth of the book, because, yeah, you know, there were days where, you know, we were in Halifax and you just lost it completely, and because of what you were working on and the pushback you were getting, not just from the government, but from ostensibly your peers. I know that I think one of the fallouts from a lot of the identity work you've done is that you don't necessarily claim identity anywhere. And one of the conversations we had about that a couple of years ago is the fact that you don't consider yourself a bioethicist. You've published an awful lot of papers in bioethics journals. Yet, you know, here is the field basically, at least a good chunk of very visible people in the field, trying to eat you alive. And It was
reason, as you know, we should explain, the reason people in certain parts of that group want to eat me alive, the others I work with actively, I mean, I'm working with Françoise Baylis now for a book for Cambridge University Press called Bioethics in Action, which looks at the kind of work Françoise and I and Carl Elliott and all these people do that actually does do aggressive defense of patient rights and human subjects' rights. So there's a lot of us who do it that way. But the people who came after me because I was, as those other folks do as well, challenging the sort of being in bed with the medical industrial research complex. So I think that's why they came after me. But, you know, the dexamethasone stuff was hard enough that even as late as a few months ago, while we were in the final edits, the final fact-checking, the lawyering of the book, and making sure every endnote was fact-checked and that it was all exactly right,
yes.
Even that late into it, I still would, when I had to go to that section of the manuscript, I would start shaking violently. And I actually had to use classical conditioning to approach it, where I had to play the same music over and over again. It happened to be Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. And I would have to start that Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony to even approach my computer before I could open those files, because it was that difficult. So I would have to say that pivot point in the book was maybe intentional in the sense of I realized I had to sort of demonstrate academic responsibility and also respond to these calls being made to me that were incredibly important, but I totally mispredicted what that was going to involve, and it turned out to involve a much greater test of kind of what I was trying to say in the book than I ever thought I was going to be tested for, and that was extremely uncomfortable. And I'm glad it makes a good read, but like I said, I don't ever want to live it again.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It was at times very harrowing just to watch, with not just the lawsuits and the filings and dealing with lawyers, but yeah, you know, just watching you have to process the emotional impact of being turned into a target, not just by your academic peers, but also by activists who wanted to construe everything you did in a very negative light. And of course, since this happened kind of, you know, at the end of the book and at the end linearly progression, do you find it gives you more sympathy in a way towards the people who have had that happen to them too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think in a weird way I have sympathy for everybody, including the devil at this point, because I think all this stuff is just a lot harder than you think. You know, my husband kind of laughed. The Chronicle of Education did a story on me a few weeks ago in conjunction with the book, and the title was The Reluctant Crusader. And he was like, reluctant, really? Because, like, why would you keep doing this stuff if you were reluctant? But then he knows the truth that, you know, the crusaders of the Middle Ages probably didn't spend some of their days curled up in a little ball crying the way that I do. So I would have to say that some of this stuff, and certainly for the folks that I've met within the bioethics group trying to push for patients' rights and human subjects' research rights, and they're getting the snot kicked out of them every day, it's tough work, and it's work that, for the most part, doesn't get recognized publicly in a way that gets support. We have to support each other, and the systems of the medical industrial research complex are so powerful and so convinced that they are the future of healthcare. These are not evil people. You know, the folks who fight us, most of them are not nasty SOBs. Most of them are, in fact, people who believe that we're just getting in the way of good science, that when we call for protections, when we call out unethical behavior, that what we're doing is damaging people's health because we're getting in the way of the progress of health science. And it's very hard to convince them that, no, you know, we all care about the same stuff. And, in fact, what we're pointing out to you is not that you're evil. We're pointing out to you that you screwed this up and that there's supposed to be protections in place here, and they're not working. But people don't always see that. These are folks who see science as the ultimate good and who kind of have the attitude that people who get caught in these systems are part of the soldiers, and, you know, in a war against disease, and it's a war always against disease, some soldiers are going to fall.
Yes.
And that's the attitude.
Excuse me. Yeah, it's really interesting to kind of be on the sidelines watching. There is definitely a very pervasive, I am doing this for the good of man. I'm doing this to solve cancer. I'm doing this to save lives. Focus to a lot of these things. And it creates a really weird position, you know, for the people who are like, maybe we should examine that a little bit closer, because, you know, suddenly you're being cast as the person who is against cancer, or is for cancer, against solving cancer, or, you know, you want all of these horrible things just because you stop and say, excuse me, hang on. And it's a very weird thing to watch, but it's also one of those things that, you know, goes back to what I was asking you earlier, which is, how do you know? You know, how do you know that you're the person who wants to cure cancer versus the person who wants to say, wait a minute, maybe cancer's got some room at the table, or whatever? Because, I don't know, like I was telling you in the green room before the show started, I was in a conversation yesterday with an absolutely brilliant scientist by the name of Danielle Lee, and an ex-NASA pilot turned writer, and that person told Dr. Lee that he was, you know, he thought Manifest Destiny was a great thing and it had done wonderful things for society, and he was like, whoa, yay, Manifest Destiny, woo. And I'm sitting there watching the exchange going, oh, holy shit, did someone just say Manifest Destiny was a good thing? Because, you know, slavery and war and genocide is all these things tied up with Manifest Destiny. Oh my God, how can you support that? But, you know, I know a lot of people who would also say, but Manifest Destiny is what caused America to be great, to spread to the West, and innovation and research and exploration and discovery. And it's interesting because, you know, you get in those situations and I still don't quite know how we necessarily get to an equilibrium where, you know, we can figure out, at least on an instant reaction, you know, or in a fast reaction, which side of that is right, which side of that is wrong.
Yeah, no, it can be difficult, but, you know, I would say that I think one of the ways you try to figure out whether or not what you're doing makes sense is to try to seek external feedback from people whose opinions you respect but who may disagree with you. And I've tried to do that in a lot of my work, and that's helped me do a lot of course corrections over the years.
Yeah.
That's been incredibly useful. But, you know, again, I think this combination of trying really hard to go for humility and disloyalty is a useful combination, because if you keep not being loyal, it gets a little lonely, but at the same time, it allows you to sort of not assume, oh, so-and-so told me this article is terrible, so this article must be terrible because I like so-and-so, as
right.
opposed to really looking at the article. And I find myself frequently writing back to people who send me something about which they're outraged, and I say, well, what if we looked at it this way? You know, the people who remain my friends are the people who can handle that I do that and who do it back to me. And
right.
I think that's really one of the ways to go, is that kind of trying to, you know, not play devil's advocate, but trying to always look for, could there be another way to think about this? And I think, you know, one of the things that happens is people like really simple stories of the good guys and the bad guys.
Yes.
And the truth is, it's not that simple.
To pay respects, homage, if you will, to a friend of ours, who's wearing the white hat and who's wearing the black hat? Somebody in our chat room, I'm going to kind of paraphrase, because they didn't quite understand what your particular interests were in history and philosophy of science. But what would you say to somebody who did say to you, well, shouldn't you be researching, or why don't you research things that are more important to more people? What would you say to that? You know, that your interest should be focused on something broader than such a tiny little thing. I mean, you know, intersex, transgender, Yamamoto, Indians, you know, whatever. Do something big.
Yeah, I do get that sometimes from people. And, you know, to me, the work the work that turns out to be interesting, the work that helps you get to the big picture ideas. And as you know from having read the book, Kelly, my book really does have a big picture overarching in it.
Yes.
I think the way you get to that is to do the fine-grained work in a small area and really try to understand how is this working in some ways as a case study. So a lot of the stuff I'm looking at in the book in some ways are representative case studies that help us understand what the big picture looks like. You know, I recently also started a nonprofit newspaper in the town where I live, which is East Lansing, Michigan. And people say to me, why the hell would you do that? Like, you write for the New York Times, you write for the Atlantic Monthly, you know, you're a major national writer. Why would you start a tiny little hyper-local newspaper? And I try to explain to them, I did it because I wrote this book, which helped look at the collapse of investigative journalism and why researchers have to take over some of that work and have to help with investigative work in our culture today, because they can do it in safer spaces. You know, and in some ways, what I saw around me locally in my own town was a total absence, because the Gannett paper, you know, buys the local press and turns it into clickbait,
right,
and doesn't really report on what's going on at city council, doesn't report on what's going on with the city attorney. So I put together a group of geeky folks who, and they're part-time, mostly as volunteers, and we have some folks who are paid, put together sort of a local press that would start taking back information flow and give people the information that they would need, and to try to do it with as much as possible, no editorializing, just the facts approach. We have no op-eds, we have no letters to the editor, we have no comments. You know, why would I do something so unbelievably hyper-local? Well, because I think it's helping me really understand, how do you start to rebuild the press in the age of the internet? How do we start to rebuild what the Founding Fathers understood was so important that it went in the First Amendment of the Constitution, the freedom of the press, the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, the freedom of inquiry? How do we begin to retake that and rebuild it at the local level so that we actually sustain it? And to me, the small projects are often where I learn the most, rather than, you know, I could go for really the big stuff, but I don't want to be Art Kaplan. I don't want to be the pundit of the big stories. I want to be the person who, you know, bothers to really learn stuff and helps to share what it is I've learned from these things. And the other reason I go sometimes for the smaller stories is because, frankly, those are the stories of people who are being ignored by everybody else, and they deserve somebody to help them. So the dexamethasone story, to my mind, is a story of, again, the intersex population being subject to remarkable amounts of abuse historically, and still today subject to remarkable amounts of abuse within systems, medical and scientific systems. And so it seems to me those people deserve somebody to work on their issues. And I'm honored to be able to do it. I'm honored to work with that population and to continue for 20 years working with that population to try to get them their rights.
I just think it's also a bit of a maybe canary in the coal mine situation. If we've got people who are running 15, 20 years of off-label patient-requested drug use, and then also portraying it as, you know, doing studies and trials, if we have these pockets of research going on that we know is unethical, and I think that there's pretty much an agreement that perhaps with the exception of some of the people who were publishing in the American Journal of Bioethics when the FDA released their report, that, you know, the fetal dex situation was unethical. There's certainly the general impression at this point that the University of Minnesota was very unethical in how they treated Dan Markingson in the Sarah Quill study. These keep popping up. You know, we had somebody in the chat room on Second Life mention this earlier, just as an aside to the conversation, that doesn't this keep happening over and over and over? Don't we keep finding out that people are doing unethical research? You know, don't we keep having these histories of, oh, well, there was the Tuskegee syphilis study, but then there was Willowbrook, and now there's Markingson, and now there's fetal dex, and on, you know, anybody who has looked into the field of medical ethics at all can just rattle off study names and unethical research projects, and yet it keeps happening, and these aren't big things when they first
It does keep happening, and I'm on this discussion email chain with about 60 international leaders in the U.S. and Europe, with regard to these questions about research ethics abuses. And one of the things that's going back and forth in this discussion is the question of, well, how do we educate people so that they understand the regulations, or how do we create more regulations so that the regulations work? And I and a couple other people are making the argument, this is the wrong approach. Like, all the regulations have failed, right, in many of these cases. The problem is not lack of knowledge. The problem is attitude. The problem is the assumption that good people can't do bad things. And as long as researchers and the rest of us think, if I'm a good person, I couldn't possibly do something bad, we're going to do bad things to each other, because you're not going to understand that in the pursuit of what you're being rewarded for, which is getting the grants, getting the publications, getting the information, getting the science done, when you're being rewarded for all of that, the people that you're using in these studies turn out to be the sort of means to the end. And you're not thinking of them as exactly as human beings. And that doesn't mean you're evil. It just means that throughout our day we go through and we don't treat everybody like a human being. So we see the driver of our bus as the driver of our bus, right? We see the person at the checkout line as the person at the checkout line. These are people who serve us on the way to our getting our lives done. And that's what happens with research subjects. So what's got to change is somehow change of attitude, not change of knowledge, because people know that bad things happen. More regulations is not going to be the solution. And in fact, you know, I've written about the fact that I don't use my IRB, my ethics board, to do the kinds of interviews that I do. And part of the reason I don't is because if I use them, then I would have more protection. And I'm not interested in protecting myself. I know that if I'm unprotected, I'm more ethical, because I'm vulnerable and scared that the people I'm interviewing are going to come after me. So when I'm interviewing somebody, I let them know what I'm doing. I take notes while we do the interview, but I give them back the notes and I let them change the notes however they want, so that what's on the record is what they want on the record. There's no gotcha. They give me back exactly what it is they want to have on the record. There's no question that I'm going to use the final version, not the previous version, in case they said something wrong or I got something wrong. And while I'm doing that, I'm having to be exquisitely attuned to their rights, because I have no protection otherwise. And I think part of the problem is the way the systems have been set up is they're all about protection of the institutions, secondarily about the protection of the researchers, and third, maybe, is the protection of the subjects. And that's messed up. But if we look historically, Laura Stark has an excellent book on the history of IRBs called Behind Closed Doors. What she shows is this is the way it's always been. It's always about legal protection of the institutions. That's why this whole system was set up. It's never been set up to protect the subjects in the system. The protection of the subjects occurs because of the fear that people will get sued, not primarily because of the need to protect the subjects. So the system is kind of broken right from the beginning, and we've got to try to figure out a different system that actually, I think, makes us vulnerable enough that we are scared every day about how our subjects are doing. And if we had such a system, then people would get less hurt. Maybe people would be then afraid to do research, but at some level, the system we have is so broken, we need something radically different at this point.
Yeah, at this point, you know, maybe going the other way wouldn't necessarily be such a bad thing. I think that might be a relatively good point to wrap up, just because I think that's such a strong statement of change and why it needs to happen. You know, when we're talking about it as if patient safety is the first thing we think of, but in reality it's more like it's third or fourth. Kind of reminds me of the joke Mike Rowe used to make on his show, on the Discovery
Dirty
Channel,
jobs.
Name, like,
if safety,
Dirty Jobs.
If safety was first, then safety would be first, and we
right?
would never do any
but it
of this
was always,
stuff.
Exactly, but in reality, it's never safety first. It's always safety third, and I think patient safety third is probably a little bit more of a truism than any of us are necessarily comfortable acknowledging.
You know, I tell people, you want to ask your doctor one thing, ask your doctor if you're in a research study and don't know it.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to say one thing, though. I did know what the overall arching theme of Galileo's middle finger was going to be when I read it. And so that wasn't necessarily a surprise. But I was surprised by one thing. And you keep saying that you think the themes are perhaps humility and disloyalty. But I think actually the thing that struck me at the end of every chapter, and sometimes through the middle, and certainly at the end of the book, was not necessarily disloyalty or humility, but humanity. The thing that really struck me as you speak to Kira, as you're talking to Bo, all of these people in your stories, from the researchers to the activists, is taking it away from the controversy, taking it away from the points people are wanting to make or score against me, and just really revealing the humanity of the individuals involved. And I found myself thinking again and again that it was an aspect of discourse that just seems to be lost so much these days, that we forget that in all of the yelling and the Fox Newsing and the wanting to be the wittiest, most succinct, quotable person in the room, that the person that we're fighting against or arguing with is also a person. And they often have really good goals in mind, too. And I don't know, I thought that you really put that to the forefront of every chapter in a really beautiful way. And it certainly made me stop and think a little bit more about how I engage with people. So,
well, cool. I'm glad to hear that.
You know, it was definitely not necessarily something that I expected to come away with, having watched you do the book, being intimately familiar with some of the stories in the book. And it was a really pleasant surprise, and it's definitely made me think. Thank you so much for being here, Alice.
Well,
this was a really interesting conversation.
Awesome.
And I appreciate you being here with your migraine, especially.
That's right.
If you hang on just a second, I want to say thank you, as always, to the Exploratorium for hosting us in Second Life, and all of our fabulous folks asking questions, and of course, my producer, Sherry Reason, who puts up with a lot to make this happen, and that's really awesome. I will talk to you guys all soon, and have a lovely evening, everyone. Good night.